WGN, here's Tom Gimbel, founder and CEO at LaSalle Network, with a few things on his mind about the Chicago employment trend. Hey, how are you again, Tom?
I'm good, John. I feel I'm optimistic.
Hold on, I'm writing this down.
I think, you know, we're going to see, we saw that Microsoft laid off some more people today to go along with some of the people that they had laid off before. I think it was 10,000 in January. And that's going to happen. And we're going to see some companies continue to lay people off. What we've also got in Chicago is we've got a really nice incubator of startups. We've got service firms that supply companies both locally and nationally and internationally. We've got really strong manufacturing companies, and I think we're going to see a rebirth of more made in the USA type of stuff. And it doesn't mean that we're not going to have some blips on the radar over the coming 6 months or 24 months, but it means that we're still Chicago. And if we, the biggest thing facing us isn't rising unemployment, it's the violence in the streets and making sure people feel safe to go to work and to leave work.
So we had some, what I thought were conflicting reports yesterday, Tom, that hotel stays in Illinois are at record levels, and yet office occupancy in Chicago is the worst in the world. I don't know how to reconcile those two.
Well, I think whenever something's the worst in the world, I always think there might be a little bit of hyperbole. But I think that what we've seen is people want to travel this summer. And we see that the restaurants are full and hotels are full. And whether it's Chicago or Colorado or New York or wherever, that people are traveling. So I think that when you say a rising tide lifts all boats, Chicago's definitely falls into that category with tourism, and it faces that. But I do think that people going into the office, it's getting better. And I think that we're going to see more and more companies continue to go into the office because employers have been looking for, and CEOs have been looking for, a way to do it that gives them the appearance of no other option. And if unemployment does tick up, that's going to say, okay, it's time to come back in the office. And once all companies are that way, then it'll start to revert back to normal.
So do you think we're going to be back to 100% of what we were before the pandemic someday?
No. I think that if we could fast forward the John and Tom time machine to a year from now,
yeah,
I would say that about 70 to 75% of companies are 3 days a week. You got another 20% or so that are 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday, and the majority of companies will be Fridays remote.
So what do you make of that?
I think it's okay. I think Monday through Thursday in the office is probably what's best for society as a whole, for business incubation, for people's health, the segue from socialization from college to work. I think that makes sense. I'm a big fan of remote work. I'm not a big fan of work from home. The differentiation is if you live near your office, you know, within 20 miles or so or 30 miles, go in. If you're taking a vacation and you want to take a few extra days but work remotely, I'm all for that. To work remotely over Thanksgiving or 4th of July week, or I'm for that. I'm not for working from home just because.
I like the sound of Friday. I do this not infrequently, but work from home on Friday, and maybe you don't really put in 8 hours, but you put in 8 hours worth of work. You get everything you need to do on Friday, and you've got a few extra hours for your weekend to travel or relax or mow the lawn. I like the feel of that. And that may be the future forever. I don't think that's a terrible thing. You know, Europe has, I think, a much more employee-friendly attitude about employment. And to me, this would lean in that direction. I like the sound of that.
Yeah, I think there's pros and cons. I think whenever somebody pulls up the Europe and pro employee, they also don't have the entrepreneurship rate that we do. They don't have the size. You know, Europe is also made up of multiple countries versus one country. There's a lot of differences between the United States and Europe to draw the parallels. and say this is good and this is bad. I think we're each our unique countries, mm-hmm. and there's positives and negatives to both. Here's the real thing, is that employees have to understand that it's a give and take. And I think for a large chunk of the past couple of years, they felt that it's just a take. And what I mean by that, as I speak for employers, is I want to work from home. I want to work remote. I want to only work in the office Tuesday and Thursday, not Fridays. I want. And I think it's got to be of what's best for the company and how do we create flexibility within that, versus me first, everybody else second. I think we've got to evolve to that point.
Tom Gimbel's the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network, thelasallenetwork.com. Good to hear you, Tom. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Always use sunscreen, John.
That's what he says lately. Not a bad tip during the summer. The warm sunshine is plenty of reason to get out and enjoy the world. A lot of companies are doing that now. We don't have COVID restrictions anymore. But Philip Weiss, you're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN, is the president of SciFarth at work, and he says if you're going to do that, be careful. Okay, Philip, what's your cautionary tale here? What are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about what should be a light and happy event, but has historically carried with it some real legal risks, John. Now that COVID is hopefully receding for good, the summer company picnic barbecue outing is really back in full swing. What's fascinating, John, is it's not just the larger companies who brought the tradition back, but this year in particular, we're seeing a lot of solo business owners banding together with other small businesses to hold a joint or communal picnic. We're seeing a lot of really small companies inviting customers, vendors, because the fact that it wasn't happening has led many to jump on board. So whether it's fully back or a first-time event, we're seeing a lot of summer outings, and that always leads to fall liability when conduct goes unchecked, and that's what we're now bracing for.
Are you you're describing how maybe businesses are inviting their customers and employees, or a couple of businesses are together. That's not the problem, is it? It's the behavior or the alcohol that's the problem, or is it both?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. It's only both in the sense that if people are engaging in a first-time event, they're not necessarily ready for what might happen. So it's the fact that it's a new experience for some small business owners, coupled with, as you say, the issues which have always been the same, which often link to too much drinking, people letting their hair down, people getting too personal. And so what we see is with more options, there's also more risk. And that's where the two really come together.
Give me an example.
So these are the good thing about talking in the wake of July 4th, not always good for the companies that dealt with it, is we're already seeing the patterns for 2023. Looking at these very small companies, John, with first-time summer outings. One really telling example is an accountant that we've actually helped out in the past invited a few clients so he could have a critical mass of people at his picnic. He only had one employee, a part-time clerk, and then served alcohol without really thinking of how much people were drinking. And it was this accountant's own employee, that solo clerk, that started sharing personal dating details, even started talking about other clients' financial status. The result was a couple of the guests actually switched accountants. Now, that's the kind of thing that you would think wouldn't happen, but if you're not thinking ahead, it often will. So that's just one example, but just another quick one for you, John. Another first-time event, this is a North Suburban house cleaning company whose owner invited his few employees to a neighborhood party he'd held before, but now he included the employees. It was around his pool. And his own employees were really uncomfortable that they were expected to don swimsuits, play volleyball in the pool, and that led to a whole lot of issues back at the workplace. So think about the activities, think about making them voluntary, and just set some parameters for yourself before planning these events.
I can see in that second example how as much fun as it would be to go to a pool party, and I guess I'd wear a swimsuit, of course, certainly if I'm going to go on the water, but If it's with the boss and he's very familiar and comfortable with his family and friends, I that doesn't sound like an environment I would be comfortable in.
Well, you're really hitting the nail on the head. The boss figured a lot of people, the employees will feel honored to be invited. The reality is, John, that these employees felt compelled to attend because it was the boss and did not want to be dressed in their swim trunks or swimsuits in front of this gentleman. So you're 100% right. In fact, one of the employees feigned a stomach bug to avoid the entire event. Others just felt they had to go. That's the kind of issue that really puts a microscope around the importance of making everything voluntary and thinking through what these events include. Like if you're going to do a big tug of war in the mud and everybody's going to end up in a giant mosh pit-like pile, maybe rethink what you considered a team-building event, because that violation of personal space is going to be inevitable, especially if people have been drinking.
In the previous example, I can see how the boss might have had only the best intentions, however short-sighted they be. What's your advice, though, for alcohol?
Yeah, well, this is always kind of the bugaboo of the summer barbecue. One really important key is you may not feel comfortable saying no drinks, because that, for some people, means no party, but set some clear limits. A lot of companies have basically provided tickets, pre-printed tickets with the company logo on them, given them to their employees. We call it ticketing the tequilas, meaning you get one ticket or two tickets, and that ensures that you will have a limit on what you drink. Don't let the party run for hours, and be watching. If someone comes in, they're already inebriated, you got to find a way to get them back home. So by managing your own approach to alcohol, you can still serve it, but also protect yourself.
It's kind of funny. I mean, if I was hosting a dinner at a restaurant or at my house, I would have alcohol, especially if the group was large enough and I knew almost certainly most of the people would want to drink. If I was doing a barbecue at a park, say, outdoor setting, maybe some beer and wine, but I think I could get away without it because, you know, we're playing softball and eating hot dogs. I think we could not have alcohol, but it's funny what a unfun party it can be perceived as if you don't have beer.
Yeah, you know, it's really, you're so right. It's really kind of the message that is being sent to a lot of employees' ears when there's the word there's going to be no alcohol whatsoever. That's why a lot of companies kind of split the difference. They do want to manage expectations, to your point, John. So what's been really effective is when you send the invite out, whether it's to your own employees or to those third parties, if you're doing the expanded guest list, remind people of your own decorum and respect rules, meaning we're going to have a great time, but it's still a company event, and these are the rules that we want to make sure everyone respects so we keep this within bounds. There's a balance between the right messaging and the right limits on the alcohol and the right activity. So it's kind of like a triangle of steps you can take so people still think, hey, we're not killing all the fun, but we're maintaining really good conduct.
For more advice like this, talk to Philip Weiss, the president of SeyFarth at Work, SeyFarth, SeyFarthAtWork.com. Thanks, Philip. Nice to talk to you.
Same here. Thank you, John.
Dennis Rodkin makes a return visit to the studio. He is the residential real estate reporter at Cranes. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, John.
Just kiddingly, I said to you, well, I wonder if anybody at Northwestern's house is going to go on the market anytime soon. The fallout from what's happened with Coach Pat Fitzgerald is seemingly unending the last 48, 72 hours. It seems like another shoe drops left and right. Of late, consideration about stalling an $800 million stadium plan. Have you looked into the stadium plan at all?
You know, I haven't because somebody else is on that beat. But I will say, as it happens, I passed near the stadium on Isabella Street, north of the stadium, on Sunday before most of this, some of this news had happened. And I did notice, you go down Isabella Street, which runs north of the stadium, and almost every house has a yard sign either saying build the stadium or saying don't build the stadium.
Oh.
But it's unavoidable. I mean, it's all up and down the street. There are signs of many kinds either saying, as I said, build it or don't build it. And I wonder about like the block party. You know, I'm in favor, you're opposed. We've both got signs in our yard, so we know how each other thinks. And then we go to the block party.
And maybe that just ruins the chemistry in the neighborhood anyway.
It might. And I mean, there are, of course, far larger issues with Fitzgerald than whether the neighbors think the stadium should be built.
But I think an $800 million project is an enormous thing, particularly since most of that money's been raised. And I wonder if some of the people who have committed the money, maybe they didn't cash the check yet, but are having second thoughts about it. I mean, think about it. That $800 million proposal is predicated on us rallying around the football program and what it does for the university. And the football program is in such dire straits today that you wonder how long is it going to take before we get the program to a point where it justifies that kind of stadium. Like, where do we get a coach? What is this going to say about players in the portal? What kind of a program are we going to have now? And is this a time to be throwing $800 million at it?
One of the articles I read about the firing of Fitzgerald, I can't remember whether it's by my colleague at Cranes, Brandon Dupree, or in another publication, quoted somebody close to the athletic department saying firing the coach is essentially a 40-year decision because you're essentially telling the football program everything ends here, we got to start over, we've got to build, we will lose some attention, as you described, from people who are upset with it. And so should you build a stadium now for a program that has possibly four decades ahead of it?
Or maybe that's why you need to build a stadium now, because it's not just a new coach that's going to fix it. You need to show some sort of commitment to the program. Does a stadium like that help or hurt real estate values around campus?
People in town we could line up people in town and I think you'd find both sides. One of the things that the neighbors in Evanston have been talking about is it's not just the football crowd. With this new stadium, it wouldn't be just the football crowds, but the concerts and the other events. And so again, I was on that street, very quiet street. You've got this giant football stadium and then regular residential neighborhood. And right now it's a very quiet neighborhood. And so one of their concerns is, you know, we have a certain number of events a year now in that football stadium, but you add concerts and the other kinds of events that might happen there. And there are people saying this will ruin, if not the dollar value of my home, certainly ruin the value of living in these quiet streets. Although other people say if Evanston gets this great new entertainment venue, the value of my house goes up.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Wrigley Field, which is still very much in a residential area and hosts more concerts now and 81 baseball games a year. So, I don't think it's hurt the value of the condominiums and apartments and houses in that neighborhood. Do you?
No, I don't think it has. I think we'd have to go back quite a while to when night games started and when the attention on Wrigley really changed. A lot of those apartments, to really find out whether things changed, a lot of those apartments and things, though, remember, they've got rooftop bleachers and party venues and things like that. There's not as much pure residential right next to Wrigley as there once was.
Yeah. I live 2.5 blocks from there, so I think I'm an expert now. But I do think what the Ricketts have done to that neighborhood was good for the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Good for the team, good for the program, good for the values of the condos. I think my home became more saleable as a result of what the Ricketts did over there than less marketable.
I think there's a huge difference, though, between the Ricketts came into an urban neighborhood, a neighborhood that was already dense, where people were already living,
used to some noise and congestion.
With the L and all sorts of other noise. And living on that, I mean, it really is, it's like a dichotomy when you look at the stadium and then the houses literally immediately across the street on this nice tree-lined street. It would be very different to bring in, I'm not saying that the people who say don't build the stadium are right. I don't have a dog in this fight. But I do think it would make a pretty considerable difference for that football stadium to become a concert venue and have things going on at more hours and later hours than has been customary.
Yeah, I get that. You have a story. These Chicago suburbs see homes selling most above the asking price. So these would be maybe by one definition, the hottest neighborhoods or the most...
Or the hardest to get a house in right now, the ones where inventory is so tight that you really have to pay over the ask. So I did this story because Redfin reported that nationwide, the average home is now, once again, selling for more than the asking price. Nobody thought this would happen
really?
Back. Yeah, this
nationwide.
Time last year. Yeah. When interest rates were skyrocketing last year, we certainly didn't think prices were going to continue to go up this way. But what happened is there's this sort of lock-in effect. All the people who bought, or many of the people who bought in previous years who have, say, a 3.5% mortgage, look at the mortgages that are 6.5% and say, I'm not going to sell my house with this low mortgage and buy one with a higher mortgage. So the inventory of homes to buy is extremely low. If I'm out there and I have to buy because I just got married, I just got divorced, I just got a new job in another region, the pickings are very slim. And so to get that house, people are paying over the asking price. And so we saw, so once again, Redfin said that this is, that nationwide, homes are selling, the average home sells for more than the asking price. I looked for the municipalities around Chicago where that's happening, where the gap is the highest, where people are having to go the highest.
And where is that?
Well, we saw Kenilworth, Glencoe, West Chicago, Norridge, Calumet Park. There's a list, you see, there's a list of 10.
Okay, I don't here have it all. Is. Well, Kenilworth is 109% over ask, which is weird because those are very expensive homes in Kenilworth.
They are, and we should say this data is based on not a lot of sales. But even so, sure, there are expensive houses in Kenilworth, but I've got the money, and I want that house that you just put on the market in Kenilworth. I'm willing to pay more.
And that may be less a function of interest rates than just people with cash. Do you suppose homes in Kenilworth are not mortgaged?
I would think that a lot of them in Kenilworth aren't mortgaged, but there still is a very tight inventory in Kenilworth.
Which is why they're getting 109%. Yeah. Calumet Park, 108.
Yeah, then go to the opposite end. Go to Calumet Park, yeah, where homes sell for $100,000, $120,000. And I found one where it came on the market at $99,000, sold for $124,000. Because the buyers said they had been through this, they'd been outbid in several bidding wars, and so they said, "Let's come in and really get this one. We don't want to miss this one." So they come in at 124 when the asking price is 99,900.
What a great day for the seller!
Yeah.
And still maybe not a bad deal for the buyer because 124,000 is not a large amount by mortgage standards.
Right.
So bite that bullet and get that house. Let's go into the WGN Radio Newsroom. We've got more business news for you. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. After several months of flat performance, marijuana sales in Illinois are up. Weed sales hit their highest levels so far this year, up nearly 8% compared to last year. The state says dispensaries sold about $136 million to recreational buyers in June. That's the largest figure since December, when the figure reached nearly $144 million. December is usually the best month of the year. Analysts say weed sales are benefiting from more outlets, including winners of new weed licenses. Illinois tourism is recovering nicely following the pandemic. Hotels across the state brought in a record amount of tax revenue during the last 12 months. They collected nearly $308 million in hotel tax revenue during fiscal 2023, which ended June 30th. That's about 36% higher than the previous year. The figure topped the previous record high of $296 million the state pulled in from hotels during its 2019 fiscal year. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you, and let's pretend we are in a noisy Chicago restaurant having to yell to carry on a conversation with our table mates. And while you do that, I'll tell you we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD.
Speak up! I can't hear you!
I said experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, enough of that. Let's pretend now we're eating in a restaurant in Northbrook during sensory-friendly dining hour.
It's basically an hour and a half on a Saturday that would offer an environment that is welcoming. quiet and respectful of their needs.
Sarah Stegner, the James Beard Award-winning chef and co-owner at Prairie Grass Cafe in Northbrook. And every Saturday afternoon in August, the cafe is welcoming people who need sensory-friendly dining.
Basically, what I want to do is offer the restaurant experience so that families that face challenges can come and be in that environment.
What's the origin of this?
I was talking to a friend of mine, and she works with families of kids that are autistic, and she was saying that it's really hard for them to have any kind of experience out in restaurants. And I was like,
And?
I try to make my restaurant nurturing and welcoming.
So she's creating a space and time for neurodiverse restaurant patrons to have that dining experience.
You know, what it can be like if you aren't able to go out into a restaurant that's really loud and noisy and it's overwhelming for you.
Tables will be far apart and the wait staff is being coached
to keep conversation to the minimum unless the people engage you. It's nice to just let them set the pace.
Reservations are required.
I'm very curious to see if people actually want to use this.
Prairiegrass.cafe is the website. They're easy to find on Skokie Boulevard. Sarah has been there for 18 years, and congrats on that.
Thank you. This past few have been very challenging.
From the farm to your belly, today is National Blueberry Muffin Day. It's National Rainier Cherry Day and National Cow Appreciation Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Dennis Rodkin on the Wintrust Business Lunch from Crane's Chicago Business is talking to us about the residential real estate market and the neighborhoods who are seeing their properties sell above asking. The national average is above ask, which means the whole nation isn't asking enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Kenilworth, 109% of ask. Calumet Park, 108. Glencoe, 106. Norridge, 105. Clarendon Hills is at 104, along with Lincolnwood, Robbins, Round Lake, Beach, Summit, and West Chicago. And also on the 100 or plus side is Winnetka and Arlington Heights. Wow. We don't have individual neighborhoods in Chicago.
No, the data is not available for individual neighborhoods, but in every one of the six counties, six metro area counties, the average is over 100%. The lowest is Cook County. It's like 100.002% of ask. So it's really 100% of ask. So the average in Cook County is that homes go for their asking price.
Still a seller's market. Bronzeville set a record for a home selling at 1.35.
Yeah, you know, this is pretty amazing. I've been tracking the new construction in Bronzeville for several years. And just 5 years ago, I was saying new record prices, high 700,000s. I was counting the dozens of $500,000 new construction homes selling in Bronzeville. Now we've got records. We've had one sale there at $1.35 million. There's another house about to close that will probably be at about the same level. I just wrote about them about a month ago, may have spoken about them in here when they were under contract. The asking prices were $1.1 million. Mm-hmm. There was one sale at that level, which is news for a neighborhood like Bronzeville. And then at the time they were under contract, the agents couldn't tell me how much they would close for. One has now closed at $1.35 million. That's a rare sight anywhere in the city, but in Bronzeville, it's a new horizon.
Yeah, what are you saying about Bronzeville? What does this say about Bronzeville?
You know, I think it has been really impressive over the course of about the past 10 years to see almost everything that sells at these prices is built on empty lots. So the more time passes and the more successful sales there are, the more of those empty lots from the years of disinvestment, from the teardown of CHA housing, the more of those go, the more of those get absorbed. Now, people who fear gentrification, people who live there, in many cases are worried that these higher prices are going to push them out. One thing is we're absorbing all these vacant lots. That's very helpful. Another, the alderman, Pat Dowell, sort of instructed me on over the years, is you bring in these people with the higher incomes, the people who can afford these homes, and that brings in the retailers. Mariano's is there, for example, primarily because they evaluate a location based on household income. So the hope is that by building on these empty lots, you're not pushing people out because you're filling an empty lot, and you're also helping to keep people stay because the retailers come in And so the hope is that this is very helpful for Bronzeville. The idea that some homes are being sold at $1.3 million, the other good piece of that is somebody's invested that in living in that neighborhood. They're going to put down roots. They want to be there. And I hope that we've gotten past the idea that we're going to shove everybody out once we get in.
Geographically, where are you talking about?
Essentially from the South Loop south, from McCormick Place to Washington Park, generally on the lakefront, generally that's called Bronzeville.
And I suppose some of these houses are closer to the water then?
Actually, the ones that sold for 1.35, they're on King Drive. They're not as close to the water, but there is some new construction pretty close to the park. There are townhouses and things going in the 600,000s near the park. A lot of it is you're still very close to the water by comparison to, say, the west side of the city or the western suburbs. But a lot of it is the proximity to downtown, proximity to transportation, and the fact that you are paying so much less for a piece of property in Bronzeville than you would on the north side.
Yeah.
Partly because that land came for so much less because it was vacant land, in many cases owned by the city.
Yeah, sometimes those lots would sell for a dollar. Not maybe in this case.
But yeah, these are now selling for much more than that, but yes.
And one more, the Printer's Row House. What about this one?
This one, is there a picture in what you've got there?
No.
This house is pretty remarkable. So when you picture Printer's Row, you picture these old loft buildings, red brick. Some of them have beautiful terracotta details. This is a building built in the last 10 years on a very slender lot right across from the train station there. Built to fit in, but not to match or emulate, not to mimic the old buildings. Red brick, beautiful terracotta screen, really a beautiful house, but very contemporary compared to the historical surroundings. It has a pool on the second floor, an outdoor pool on the terrace. Came on the market at over $5 million last year, just sold for $4.8 million. Nobody has ever in the city paid more than that anywhere south of Ida B. Wells Drive. It came in even above the record price in Hyde Park. There's nothing south of Ida B. Wells that has ever sold for this. And this house is remarkable. I'm sorry the pictures aren't there, John. I may be able to send them to you later. It's a beautiful, beautiful contemporary home. Has a retail space on the first floor, so it fits, which is your tenant. So it fits in to the neighborhood, which has a lot of retail. And then you've got three stories above that, including a big outdoor terrace with a pool.
So it's not just a home. It's a property with retail space down
with
below?
With retail space below.
So it generates some income, presumably?
Yeah, generates some income.
Probably not enough to finance a 7,000-square-foot, five-bedroom manse.
Probably not, but it helps. Yeah, it helps. And one of the things about this house, when this architect and his wife built it, the lot, which had been, as far as I could tell, had been vacant since for more than a century, you could have built a 12-story building on it. It could have been a tall, slender condo building. They put just a single-family home, which I think is nice for the neighborhood.
Dennis Rodkin, residential real estate reporter. Always interesting. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, John.